Hello and welcome to the Oxford Sidebar podcast for February 2013, brought to you by the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association. Our speaker this month was Dr. Joey O'Gorman from Central St. Martin's. His talk was entitled Creativity and Science, Dispatches from the Art World. We hope you enjoy.
Yeah, so I was doing molecular biology initially until about a year ago. And then when I was coming to the end of my first postdoc, I was looking at changing into research in a different field and was thinking of doing something a bit more interdisciplinary. And at the same time, I was building up my art practice, which I'd always done art since I left school. Someone said to me, oh, there's this art and science thing. So I started looking into art and science, and it seemed there was quite a lot of interest building around it. And sort of negotiated a research affiliation with Central St. Martin's. So they just started an MA in Art and Science. So I went to, I'm based there now doing some research, and I occasionally help teaching a bit on this MA. Yeah, I'm doing my research while I'm building my art practice at the same time. Just like trying to see how my experience in research science, how that sort of ties in with what people think about science and what different people have written about science, and trying to speak to artists a bit more about what science is. Quite an extreme difference going from sort of science in Oxford and the dream of spires and some fussy old SERs and things like this, going to the Central St. Martin's brand new building in the middle of London, surrounded by fashion and design students. It's quite a different place, and fairly soon sort of realised that artists have quite a different perception of scientists than scientists do themselves. As you'd imagine, like everyone here probably doesn't think of science as a boring and a non-creative sort of thing, otherwise you wouldn't be here. But the general perception of the sciences is that in the art sphere is that science is very boring, and yeah, quite a lot of the general stereotypes are here in the media, so something between Dr. Frankenstein going all the way to some sort of meek, sociophobic person, I don't know. But the truth is that we're all scientists, at least I can still call myself scientists, so I'm normal people, have normal interests and normal lives, and they're not much different from anyone else. So I thought one of my first goals I needed to do was to get across to artists and art students what science is, and explain my experience in scientific, what my experience has been within research science. So to do that, initially you have to define to them a little bit about, explain to them what science is from quite a basic level. So for me, one of the initial things is just defining what science is, which is like for me, it's a process of a process by which you produce theories which predict and model the world, so you can manipulate the natural world and make predictions. Sometimes there are quite broad definitions of science which include the empirical, any empirical research, so things like history and what have you. But today I'm going to limit myself to thinking of science as the natural sciences, so things like physics and chemistry and biology. So the other thing that I need to get across sometimes to them is that there's quite a big difference between taught science and research science. So within taught science, you get this canon of scientific facts, which is taught as if it's concrete fact, right and wrong. And this is what most people sort of come across at school, and one of the main things that puts people off. But this is, research science is quite a different beast, where you have a lot of competing theories, which might be contradictory, and there's quite a lot of subjective element deciding. Trying to make decisions about what might be right and what might be wrong. And also the historical conceptions of what science was seem to have changed quite a lot. So science historically used to be seen as this linear logical pursuit which is progressing towards some sort of truthful conception of reality. Whereas now those people see it as sort of a bit of a non-linear process which involves some of these subjective elements and has a very complex relationship with what truth might be and what reality might be. So
another thing that they're interested in is what a scientific method might be. And historically, there are a lot of discussion about what scientific method might be. In the 18th and 19th century, people, there's a lot of talk about things like inductivism and applying the threads to deductivism. So inductivism is where you look at the world, generalize and then form some laws, whereas hypothetical deductivism is where you form some hypotheses and then you test the predictions in experiments. And both of these are sort of gross oversimplifications which aren't really borne out by historical facts. It doesn't seem that many people ever really stick to them strictly. In real life, science is very complicated. A lot of different methods used for different specific problems, and it's still a bit mysterious what science might be. Unsurprisingly, people are still trying to work out why science is so successful. So I was going to say a little bit about my own experience in science, in research science. When you look at in a lab, a lot of things are based on personalities. Different labs have different structures, and it depends on the group leader's personality and different people within that lab. And there's a sort of master-apprentice relationship between PhD students and postdocs within a lab and a group leader. And a lot of what the group leader thinks, the theories they prefer and the different techniques they hold up, these things can sort of bias the training a younger scientist gets. Not necessarily in a bad way, but at the forefront of the frontiers of science, it's not a very standardized training. So it's very dependent on the interaction with someone who's actually doing the job, actually doing research. So another thing which is not necessarily expected by people who don't know anything about science is that you have very different lab cultures. So you get some labs are real sort of social hives of activity where everyone's happy and everyone's helping each other out with their experiments, and then you get other ones where there's something's gone seriously wrong, sort of sterile, silent environments, and people visiting the lab are sort of confronted by a bunch of unsmiling, unhappy people. And all these sort of environments bleed into sort of the way you work and the way you interpret different data and things like this. Another thing that's a bit people don't necessarily appreciate about science are sort of dark arts, or people are selling their stories. So people have to try and extract their money out of funding bodies, and they have to try and get past an editor to try and publish something. And in order to do this, they quite often have to sort of create quite an appealing narrative to their work. Sometimes use quite a lot of trendy buzzwords to try and make their research look appealing. And if they really want to get into the high impact journals, they need to be doing sort of working quite sick. So what I was talking about with subjective judgments, they're quite a lot of elements of subjectivity and creativity within the scientific process. So at the level of, say, creating hypotheses, you might need to put contemporary knowledge and what's considered to be true to one side for a while and sort of think of something which is contrary to accepted truth, and move forward and try and test a new hypothesis and develop a new theory, and basically make things up. And quite often these things don't bear out, and it's back to the drawing board. But sometimes they do bear out, and there's a little bit of modification and quite a lot of new observations that a new theory might come to be and eventually turn into a scientific fact. And that's where it sort of might potentially bleed into the scientific canon, into the taught science, and that's sort of what people experience. Even when what's taught science regularly changes and is updated. So different people have different attitudes and interpret things differently. People assess work depending on their personal experiences and the attitudes of their mentors. And there's a plethora of speculations which go on throughout the unpublished environment. So in seminars and conferences, people think very speculatively. And they don't talk about this very publicly. It's generally sort of quite in-house, but it's one of the driving forces of how people create new hypotheses, and probably one of the reasons why it's very hard to pin down who made the discovery and where a discovery was made, because everyone's been talking about it in the pub for years. So Husserl, the philosopher Husserl, talks about something called pre-science, which he thinks enables science. And for me, the sort of idea of pre-science connects to the sort of social and cultural embedding that our subjective and creative elements of science happen. So for me, this pre-science isn't separate from science, but it's within science. And these subjective elements happen at the frontier, and it's only after you accumulate a lot of data new interpretations come to the fore that eventually you can make objective judgments. And when you make good objective judgments about one theory, is it more powerful than another theory, then you can sort of move into some sort of fact, even though this is still just provisional knowledge and might be overturned in the future. So all of these things sort of painting a picture of something which is quite dynamic and has quite a lot of human activity going in, and it's not just a bunch of dry automatons working away slavishly in a lab, soon to be replaced by computers or machines. So the other thing about the scientists generally don't have a training in philosophy of science, and quite a lot of scientists have of the opinion that this is absolutely unnecessary, and I'll probably agree with that myself. I didn't really have training as a PhD, I definitely didn't have any philosophy of science, and in my undergraduate there were any optional things, and I learned a bit about Enlightenment science, so 17th, 18th century history of science, but that's about as far as it went, and that was just because I chose that option. But even though people haven't trained, people seem to be aware of things like terms like the paradigms of falsifiability and things like Occam's razor, and through some sort of cultural osmosis, people seem to know sort of things which are relevant to science, but they're not set in stone concrete things which they're taught, this is how you must do science. So my next stage is trying to think about how I speak to science through artists, is to think about how other academics thought about science and what can history and philosophy of science teach us. So one important book is, which quite a lot of people in the room may have read, and even if you haven't read it, you're probably aware of the key concepts. Is Thomas Kuhn's 1962 Structure of Scientific Revolutions. So Thomas Kuhn introduces the contemporary idea of what a paradigm is. And a paradigm is an overarching collection of theories which dictate a particular view of nature. And Kuhn thought of science as advancing in different periods with different types of science happening at different times. So you go through periods of normal science where everyone adheres to a paradigm, and basically people just extend and refine theories. And then as we're going through a period of normal science, you get an accumulation of data which contradicts the paradigm, and this leads to crisis. And then the crisis is only resolved by revolution. And during revolution, a whole new paradigm is coming, and a paradigm shift is another concept that people seem to be familiar with. So a whole new set of theories come in, and a new world view which is completely incompatible with what went before. So Kuhn also started talking about science as if it's basically just a problem-solving endeavor. So it's nothing special, and theory choice is just based on making decisions about things like accuracy and simplicity. And it's been quite contentious figure in some circles. And the next person I'll talk about disagreed quite strongly with him. So another philosopher who's been very, very influential in science circles at least is Karl Popper. And Karl Popper he believed that scientific theories can't really be proved true, it's just more credible. And he introduced the idea that to be truly scientific, something should be falsifiable. So there's some problems with if you take on false suppliers, if you completely take it on. There are a few problems with you might throw out quite a lot of queries because they can be proven to be true. And also you might throw out a theory which might be really useful and working really well just because in some instances it's proven wrong. So this goes against some of the thoughts of the early 20th century American pragmatists who thought that there was an economy of science which allowed it to work efficiently. So they thought that scientists basically deal with theories which work okay, and they weren't necessarily concerned with trying to get work with theories which explained everything exactly. So Wally, Karl Popper also disagreed and had some really highly publicised arguments in debates with Kuhn about his conception of normal science. So for Popper, you didn't have these long periods where scientists just refined and developed theories, but you thought that they continually questioned paradigms, and this is a... it's not really a valid conception, this normal science thing. And that bears out, that's borne out in contemporary thought, which a lot of the contemporary histories of science think that revolution is basically retrospective reconstruction of the transformations which accumulate during these periods of normal science. So a revolution isn't really fixed in time, it has occurred during this normal science. So another person who's been quite important and has quite a lot to say which resonates with my experience of science is a philosopher of science called Paul Fairbairn, and he wrote a book called Against Method which ruffled quite a few feathers, and a lot of people criticise him because he says anything goes in science. But he didn't mean literally that anything goes in science, but rather that there are a lot of different methods and there's no overarching common structure to science. Which for me, that's my experience of how science goes and a lot of historians out there research. He also thought that the advancement of science requires scientists to have a disrespect for prevailing methodologies. He introduced the idea of counter-induction. So I just wanted to read a quote which is described counter-induction. So he says, the first step in our criticism of customary concepts and customary reactions is to step outside the circle and be able to invent a new conceptual system, for example a new theory, that clashes with the most carefully established observational results and confound the most plausible theoretical principles, or to import such a system from outside, from religion, from mythology, from the ideas of incompetence or the ramblings of madmen. This step is counterinductive. Counterinduction is thus both the fact science could not exist without it and the legitimate much needed move in the game of science. So contemporary sociology and history agree with this, and this is my experience as well, that the scientific process is a very messy and complex affair, and it's not taught to people. The ideas of the scientific method aren't really taught, landed about it. And it's just summed up by a quote from the physicist Percy Bridgman, who says that scientific method is what working scientists do, not what other people or even they themselves think about it. No working scientist, when he hands an experiment in the laboratory, asks himself whether he's being properly scientific, nor if he's interested whether the method he's using is actually a method. Scientific method is something she talks about by people standing outside and wondering how scientists manage to do it. After having come to sort of think of science as quite a complex, nuanced process, I need to ask what can art and science do by coming together? What's the work? Is there any value in bringing art and science together? So, as probably most of you are aware, there's a long-standing cultural rift between the arts and the sciences. And this goes back a long way. In the 19th century, John Mill wrote a couple of essays talking about a deep cultural divide between conservatives and liberals. On the one side, he talked about conservatives like Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who was influenced by things like German idealism and was primarily interested in the meaning of things. And he support of the Conservatives, who were traditionalists and opposed to social change, being opposed by the Liberals. And the Liberals were people who believed in science and believed in social progress. And these were stereotyped by the utilitarian thinker Jeremy Bentham. And Jeremy Bentham used logical analysis and empiricism to try and activise the changes in law and governance to raise the standards of the common good. So these long-standing divisions continue until today. In 1959 there's a famous speech by C.P. Snow called The Two Cultures, which bemoans this continuing antagonism between different cultures, between scientists on one side and literary intellectuals on the other side. In the later 20th century, there's like continuing sort of issues between science and people from non-scientific communities, and you get people like philosophers like Heidegger and Habermas who warn us against scientism and just trying to explain our experience of the world through scientific explanations and the disavowal of critical reflection and things like this. But it's important to say, even though these are phenomenologists, even though they're deeply influential within the arts and the humanities, they didn't disavow science, and they didn't. They were just wondering about its place in the world. And there are problems with anti-scientism becoming anti-science. And when you get to a sort of stage of anti-science, you introduce the sort of idea of obscurantism. So you can start sort of saying, okay, well, science doesn't tell us anything, and maybe it's all these causal explanations are nonsense, and God does everything. You can sort of come in expecting sort of quite mystical things if you don't think you have an anti-scientific thought. So in the 1990s, this sort of Cold War heated up a bit. It was an affair called the Science War. I don't know how, if people are familiar with the Science War, but I certainly wasn't when I first started reading about it about a year ago. In 1996, the physicist Alan Sokol wrote a hoax article which went into a postmodern journal called Social Text. So he wrote this article in a sort of containing a load of known scientific faux pas, and when it was published he said, oh, it's a hoax. And he was basically just trying to demonstrate in his mind that a meaningless text could be published as long as it referenced enough popular postmodernists. So when he did this, the hoax was publicized. Decades of antagonism which had been building up within American faculties between the arts and sciences came to a head. There was a lot of bad blood, a lot of outraged scientists on one side, and outraged anthropologists and sociologists and historians on the other side, fighting in the press, mostly the popular press, not in academic sort of publications. A lot of mudslinging, a lot of misrepresentation, and it's quite funny, so that's probably worth the text itself is worth reading as well. Even it's quite cheap and good. The text itself misrepresents the things. But just shows that you have the ongoing antagonism between the arts and sciences. And a lot of people I'm now working with within the arts are very influenced by the ideas which are the root cause of these problems. So for me, overcoming this animosity between art and science is quite an important thing when I'm working within this sort of sphere of art and science, and overcoming prejudice against scientists. Quite a lot of people, popular philosophers who are very influential within arts don't really like scientists, and those ideas bleed through sort of sometimes, not everyone, obviously not everyone, but some people really don't like scientists. And one of the main problems is that people from different disciplines judge each other by the criteria of their own discipline. And then you have other problems with specialised jargon and language getting in the way of people. So one of the main things that people who work within the sort of interdisciplinary environments like art and science, they see themselves as peace brokers and want to try and work between the disciplines without stepping on anyone's toes and avoiding the bear traps that are out there, sort of with sensitive issues and people using the wrong sort of language and winding up on it. So for me, why art? Art's quite a powerful thing. And one of its key things that it can do is it can communicate complex ideas without resorting to specialist languages. So I think it's quite well positioned to sort of mediate these problems between different academic fields, and also opens up academic fields being able to speak to the public. And being able to speak to the public about something like science is really important because it affects all of us, and the more the public know about how science, what science is done and how it's done, then we can have more informed ideas about questioning policy. So there's other aspects as well which artists can do, where they can move into sort of the areas which science is concerned with, which are restricted to scientists. So scientists are restricted in what they can say because of career concerns. So they can't necessarily comment on a lot of things because it might conflict with what their employers think, and they might not get any funding in the future. There are a lot of problems with sort of community politics. You don't want to upset senior scientists because they might be reviewing your papers or giving you a job in the future. And if you say something which is could be taken out of context, there could be problems with your competitors using it to criticise you. So there are a lot of things that scientists are restricted in saying that artists can sort of move into these areas and sort of they don't have a danger of saying things like talking about the public's concerns over what's being researched. And the same with scientists. So something that I was interested in doing was trying to create a semi-formal environment where you could use art to legitimise scientists to speak more openly, to speak more speculatively about things without the fear of sort of upsetting people, which they do if they restrict it in things that they wouldn't be able to say in more formal environments. I think there's potential there for the people to be able to interact with the public and interact with other academic environments within an art sphere, which they couldn't do within a normal academic sphere. This is also quite an important issue at the moment because DIY biology is sort of moving into view. So with more and more scientific information being publicly available, the experiments you can do are getting cheaper and cheaper. And a lot of the legal restrictions have been removed from a lot of amateurs activising and getting laws clarified. And this is raising the possibility of people, home researchers, as it were, being able to ask questions which are overlooked by the primary funding bodies. And it'd be really nice for scientists who actually work within science to be able to engage in these conversations about what we could research and what we should research, without fear of damaging their career. So that's all well and good. Art and science come together. That might be there might be some things that people working between art and science could do, which could benefit the public and benefit different academic circles communicating with each other. But for me, one of the other questions I was initially interested in, where's the creativity in science, and potentially where's the art in science? So throughout history, art and science have had some degree of contact. From the Renaissance, you have polymaths like Leonardo. Through the Enlightenment, you get romantic conceptions of the heroic scientists. And then modern day contemporary artists might be some sort of do art which technophilic art which has some level of activism involved, which relies on their understanding of science or technology to activate. Quite a lot of art might be influenced by scientific process and scientific discoveries. And sometimes science has been very important in art, so especially in things like early painting and pottery, the technologies were sort of cutting edge science at the time. But what I was more interested in a way was these instances where you get scientists talking in aesthetic terms about their work. So talking things like beautiful theories and beautiful results, sometimes talking about being inspired, their work being the creative process of their work, coming up with new ideas and new theories, being inspired by some sort of mysterious source, mystical source. So everyone seems to agree that there's a lot of creativity involved in creating hypotheses, and when you're doing experiments there's a lot of innovation involved when you're doing new experiments. No one's done them before, so you have to import new technologies and come up with new ideas, so that's all quite creative. And also in the interpretation of data as well, there's quite a lot of creativity that might be involved, because you might have conflicting data, or there might be other stuff out there that's published which is conflicting with what you're looking at, so there could be a degree of creativity there. So in contemporary art now, there's the idea of drawing has expanded to include quite a lot of things which people who have no interest in art might be quite surprised to think drawing might be. So it goes as far to include sometimes things like performance and what have you. And for me, my own scientific research could potentially be conceived as a drawing practice. So in this case, the physical actions and central inputs are involved when you're performing an experiment, combined with the thoughts you have when you're thinking about your research, can be viewed as a form of drawing. And in this case, the media is the mind, and through the process of performing your experiments and thinking about the things, you sculpt the substrate, which is your mind. And while you're doing your experiments, new ideas can come into your mind as you're working, and if these resonate with those structures which are created in your mind, maybe you can conceive a new model, a new theory, or potentially if there's some sort of dissonance, you might come across a problem with your experiment. Potentially there's some sort of cognitive aesthetic happening there, and this could relate to what scientists talk about when they're talking of something being beautiful or seeming just right. But maybe this aesthetic will remain esoteric to people who aren't initiated in science and aren't actually working in the science, because it doesn't really resonate with their mind. Now, I totally understand that a lot of people completely disagree with that, because it's a completely personal interpretation of science. But that's the power of art. It's not reliant on having an objective external assessment if it's right or wrong. So there are other aspects as well where there could be some sort of art at work within science. So for me, quite a lot of scientists are like virtuoso artists when they interact with their instruments. Certain people, even within the science community, can do things that other people just can't do through the deftness of their touch and through the subtlety of their understanding of changing technologies and changing scientific knowledge. And also at the other end of the spectrum, there's just drawing in the normal sense of drawing. So within the lab, people often use drawing to explain things. And even though a lot of scientists aren't good draftsmen, or some might be good draftsmen, but they don't have to be good draftsmen, they're not afraid to pick up a pen and paper. And when they pick up that pen and paper, they're not necessarily just translating what's in their mind onto a piece of paper. They can be thinking through, they can use it as a means of thinking through an experiment, trying to arrange different elements within a system, or thinking of topological arrangements, and either communicating more deeply with another scientist or thinking through themselves. This touches on something which the great Spanish neuroanatomist Santiago Ramón y Cajal said. So he notes that when observation is accompanied by sketching, the act of representing distorts and strengthens the attention, forcing us to examine the entire phenomenon. And that we should infuse the things that we observe with the intensity of our emotions and with a deep sense of affinity. We should make them our own in our heart. We should make them our own where the heart is concerned, as well as in the intellectual sense. Only then will they surrender their secrets to us, for enthusiasm heightens and refines our perception. So for me, art's at the heart of science, even if the overarching benefits of science is distinct from art because of its relation to objective reality. The American pragmatist John Dewey thought that art could play a role in enabling people to perceive and manipulate and grapple with reality, and its function should not be remote from our lives. He argued that if you convey knowledge, which is not easily reducible to a series of propositions. So for me, science is of great importance and has profound implications for the welfare of humankind. And even if we can't all understand all the science, it's useful for us to know what it does and what we can do with it. So for me, refusing art helps people to engage with this most fundamental part of our lives. I'm sure it's a worthwhile thing. So that's me for now. Maybe I'll convince you there's some art within science. Any questions?
You mentioned one way to reconcile the artists and the scientists. You mentioned how the scientists provide it's for them to express their ideas without jeopardizing their reputation, the future, employability. Do you know any other means as well to reconcile both parties and what about the artists with the scientists?
You mean like so?
Likewise with the scientists.
Yeah, the other way around. Yeah, that's is another thing, I suppose, which the endeavours or aren't sciences are trying to do in explaining what science is a bit more clearly and breaking down some of the prejudices, because primarily a lot of the prejudices are more to do with misunderstanding, misrepresentation, and people applying standards that might be relevant within their own sphere, but when it comes to talking to someone from a different area, it's very relevant. So probably more just about promoting good manners, I suppose. So a lot of people wouldn't consider calling a lot of other people a load of rude names, but they seem quite happy to do. So I don't really know what the most constructive form of reconciling scientists and artists is.
Why don't artists I'm a scientist, so I know why scientists don't like artists.
I think there are a lot of issues around, say, people conceive sometimes perceive scientists as being puppets of the techno-industrial complex, and all that's wrong with the world is like the Second World War, nuclear arms races because of scientists. And I think it's this conflation of things which are outside of even the science, why we do science and how we use science, it's conflating that with science. I don't know, for me I think there's some degree of confusion, and it just suits certain people's rhetoric, and sometimes just a lazy referencing of all these stereotypes and things like this. And people like to pose themselves against something that's different, like the rules. So yeah, I can't speak for it. They don't always hate scientists. Yeah. It's becoming more and more common with their undergraduate degrees coming out of combination. In America it's been going on for 5 or 10 years, and on the continent a few places as well, with far more people being taught in multidisciplinary environments where get people that converse, and some people would say there are potential problems with that because it even reinforces the difference between disciplines by teaching them together.
I actually find history when you do history is actually quite, it's quite scientific in a way, because you have to
Yeah,
it's empirical research.
And there is the it's fine, you know, it's actually quite helpful.
A lot of it is, I mean, that's empirical research, like, quite some historians would don't like that type of history making. And if general sentiment is going to change, I don't know. In the UK, we still have this like very clear system. People at 15, 16 have to decide, am I going to do science or am I going to do humanities? And I've always done, I mean, I myself had to choose between art and science when I was 15, like what I was going to do from A level. I only ever did science like for 10, 15 years in my bedroom. It's only the past like 3 or 4 or 5 years that I've like been putting it out there a bit more. So yeah, I'm not really sure, but hopefully please.
I just want to say congratulations and reading reflections of scientists and artists who worked together recently came from Well Project, which has essentially sent a scientist to look at the building. So a lot of controversy at the time, but they became part of this. So they said, well, what are they going to do? And the reflections of the group and the book they published has been really interesting, because the artists who reflected on actually working with scientists day to day. And the scientists' perspective of the change in the field, they had people in very, and they had artists from all different types of disciplines, paintings, and if you want to pursue that, that was a really interesting reflection.
Yeah, and exposure does definitely, that seems to be one of the main things. If an artist exposed to a scientist, they can see they're just a normal person that sort of has a life, and maybe they can sort of see them as something other than just some weird weird bogeyman who's ruining their life or something, vice versa as well. Scientists are exposed to some artists and stop seeing them as lazy morons. I don't know what they are. People, there are a lot of awful stereotypes that go the other way as well.
Isn't this some of this though, in trying to bring people together? Because there are years from kind of growing the start where you can bring people together, but then I think the whole point is that people need to work together. You really see how you work and then try and do that together in some way. And I suppose the reason why art and science is more than sort of coherent and spectral, but is that
Why should I let have like an artist walking around my laboratory, or I'm not getting anything out of it? So sometimes like a very big scientist who has like an established career might do it as like a vanity project, like saying, oh look, but that's not representative of the majority of scientists. There's a majority of people working in science, based on like PhD students and technicians, but it's a whole community of people that are sometimes there's John Davis, there's an artist called John Davis who works in MIT at the lab, and there's quite a lot of his postdocs who would say, who the hell is this guy? He's like, you don't want him in here. I don't appreciate what he's doing. But the head of the lab and the bombs, I love this guy in prison. So yeah, I don't know if that was going towards the question or not.
There is an artist in residence at the
Center. Yeah, there's loads, and it's been some, like the vast majority of times, artists in residence is a positive thing. It helps people. That was just one example of the bad.
Just saying that there.
Definitely, yeah. No, I agree. There's a lot around. They're everywhere. Probably someone in your lap, but no one else is not.
So I have a similar background as you guys, because I started my undergrad as cultural anthropology, and now I study evolution of disease. But so it strikes me that, you know, one thing in the early graphic science, when you talk about the philosophy of why this is about, that scientists are really committed to and rely on this idea of opportunity, especially in a practical standpoint, in terms of benefit and finding. It's the public to say, you should be eating healthy, right? Or whatever that information turns out to be. So
I mean, my own personal view with this background is that science is not necessarily constrained and whatnot, but when you start to bring that up to a lot of scientists, they often start to get worried, not only for their own school, but like, how do you talk to scientists about that, or what are you doing, or ways to sort of
It's a complex situation where there's some elements of subjectivity there, especially within the discovery process and how you come up with new hypotheses and at the level where you have conflicting things going on. So at a certain stage, some level of objectivity comes in where you can say, if I put on my empirical realist hat, I would say that one theory can predict something, one model of the world can predict certain things better than another, and you can objectively say this thing performs better than the other. So at a certain stage, some level of objectivity comes in. That doesn't go as far as like saying this is, which is what a lot of, upsets a lot of people in the other sort of philosophical camps. It doesn't go as far as like saying this is the truthful, objective reality, blah, 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 these sort of things. So for me, it's a nuanced picture. Anyone who wants to sort of distill it down to like a symbol, you're this, you're that, or you're against me, probably says more about their agenda and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to promote or what they're trying to pull down, and isn't really relevant to like a good conception of what science is and its relation to the real world and reality and subjectivity.
That rings a bell from my side, from a history background, and I think, you know, that idea, some of it's actually constructed and so forth, what can be, you know, postmodernism, like, you know, you've got a lot of historians who thought they could know some stuff but shook them quite hard. But partly it's about trying to get as close as you can get, and I think to some extent is that what science is doing. You're saying knowledge is provisional and can't absolutely pin everything down, but we can get closer to a truth and we sort of believe in that process, does it make sense? So I would always be separated from my subject by 700 years and won't really know what happened. So I want to get closer to it.
If you sat a scientist down for a few hours and like taught them some history and philosophy, they might think that, but the vast majority of them don't even think about these things. A lot of scientists do just think, you know, obviously, like any layman, don't think about what they do as equating to some sort of objective reality, which is the truth. And for me, that's fairly close to the truth. But, you know, I'm not going to shut that down someone else's throat. So, yeah, I don't know, these things are all about, different environments, people sort of making different arguments. And within sort of very specialised academic environment, people can have these sort of arguments, but I don't know how much sense they make within a sort of normal conversation for people to sort of deny what seems like a really normal conception of reality. Sort of, this is solid.
I guess that sort of my larger question is how we can have that discussion in a setting, but how do you then say, okay, from a positive, not for you, just for the things that you've done, but you know, how do you translate to teach how to think?
Probably need to start with teaching scientists to think about science, maybe. in a way, I'm not sure if I agree with that, because one of the reasons science is so successful, the way it stumbles forward so effectively, is because it's this messy process where there's not set things. It's very much like evolution. You have a lot of different things happening and niches open up and those niches get filled. If you try to plan it and program it and say this is what we're going to do and define it too much, you probably get as far as the North Korean nuclear program. It's not really, I don't think that's the way science works, so I don't know, I'm quite reluctant to teach to scientists to sort of learn about history of philosophy or science. I don't think it necessarily benefits science. I don't think it necessarily benefits their what they do as well, like to have some sort of
fundamental sort of drive that what you think you're doing is linked to fundamental reality is potentially a good thing, and it gets you out of bed in the morning. So, you know, you can see that you're going to have tangible benefits, they're going to save the world. I don't know if that answers the question. Arts change quite a lot, there's so many different forms of practice and people do different things, so yeah, I don't know, some people are amazingly do a lot of stuff with computers, which is probably at the same sort of level as any computer scientist. Some other people sort of have a really deep understanding of ecology and ecosystems and things, because they're activizing within that. A lot of them have some quite, yeah, I don't know, it's hard to talk about art as a one thing.
I'm just basically
getting
impression that obviously it was only one era.
Yeah, yeah.
You
wanted
to be kind of absolutely
given
to the
other way.
You had to do that, you had to go in.
There
were only
exceptions, you had to go to do that stuff because it was just running across the whole life. And that's a really good point as well, because some people sort of feel that's something which is really lost. Even though there's still quite a lot of schools out there that do more recently things like the Prince's Drawing School, which has actually been going for about 20 years, but they sort of, it was brought in because this taught drawing had gone, sort of, these skills had been lost over like 20, 30 years, they'd been kind of expunged as if it was wrong that you couldn't teach this in art school. So nowadays quite a lot of art schools do have courses and do have aspects of their courses which have like a high level like of more old-fashioned, as it were, skills in painting and drawing. So it's all on the up again.
Yeah. I remember from what you said earlier, that you're a practitioner of the arts. Can you tell us what sort of an artist you are? And how it's affected your scientific thinking? That's one part of the question. The second question is, do you think James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis is an example of the application of art thinking to scientific thinking?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, he's an amazing man, but answering the second first, the Gaia hypothesis, which I don't know where I stand on that precisely, but he's definitely an amazing man, and he's an inventor as well, so he's done so many things. I would myself be able to see that as a very creative sort of idea, and the synthesis of so many things, and it's this sort of this leap to like a different scale to be able to think of something, think of systems and biological systems on the scale of the planet, and then to merge this with science, to back it up with science as well, it's quite an amazing thing. So yeah, probably is quite a nice example of the synthesis between sort of art and science. And the first thing,
what sort of artist are you, and how has it affected your scientific thinking? Yeah.
So I'm primarily a visual artist, so I use quite a lot of digital work, but I also concentrate on a drawing practice where I try and think about the way things are related to each other, so the way things in science, in society and culture are related to each other, so I try and think through these things by creating drawings. So mainly visual artist. And has it influenced my science? I'm not sure, for outside of my final sort of description of what how science could be sort of an artistic pursuit, I sort of argue potentially the science I was doing was art to a certain degree anyway. But the actual art we produced probably didn't directly affect it, apart from using a bit of Photoshop to digitize my films and things like that. Yeah, so just on a purely practical sort of level. Probably one and the same in some spheres, but the stuff that I've sold over the past 3 or 4 years, I think my practice has changed quite a lot in the past year as well. So trying to sort of think around a lot more of these ideas of creating forums to bring people together to think and things like this, and think of an art practice as something that's not necessarily just producing objects, but doing things and doing action and enacting things which can change things. So yeah, probably not so much effect on science in the past.
So you, one of the main things I see from this is, yeah, it's great, artists trying to understand scientists, scientists trying to understand artists, but the wider non-scientific, non-art-related public don't understand either.
Yeah.
And how do you bring that out? And to the extent where the BBC or popular press is frightened to put a graph
out
there and show people things, or frightened to put some nice piece of sculpture up there and try and explain, because they can't understand it themselves.
Yeah, there's definitely this sort of...
It should be that it brings it out to the public.
Yeah.
So that we value the arts and value, well, the higher arts and the higher sciences.
Yeah, we might it is depressing seeing things like dumbing when things are dumbed down, but then also there is the issue of when is something virtually esoteric, because it's just the sort of practitioners can understand it. Like a lot of contemporary art and art theory has really disappeared into the stratosphere, and you'd have to be really, really into it to sort of get to the bottom.
Similarly
of
with science.
And similarly with science, yeah. I'd say that's a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, most people are only touched by art and science by their mobile phone and the pictures they receive around mobile.
I think health is quite a powerful way into science for some people. If you have something wrong with you, then you need to know. I think it's like
sometimes. Yes.
But that's only one.
A lot of the good examples of art and science collaborations are around sort of things like reflecting our concerns about science and reflecting our concerns about how science impacts and things like health and climate change and ecology and things like this. And you have like these real tangible things, and sometimes they can be quite a nice inroad if you can show the relevance to someone of something, then maybe they'll look into it more. And I think in the UK, a French friend of mine who I thought might have been dead tonight, he really lauds the BBC's popular science programs. Like, things like Horizon and things are amazing. In my mind, they're really good. I think they're pretty jazzy now, but they still sort of do get across some pretty hard messages somewhere.
They don't have a large audience, though, do they? I mean,
no, it's hard to say because I'm a fan of the content.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. And the Scarlet Knight,
the Scarlet Knight has set the standard. It is not patronising, it's not, you know, it's everything that most modern science programmes are.
Yeah. And for me, that's a bit of art and science. That programme itself is shows this deep human engagement with the subjects. So no example, but yeah, they're not very popular.
Your last question there was about the proper understanding of art and science and a disconnect. Do you think that's also not just about lack of understanding, it's a lack of emotional connection? People don't see that it's meaningful for them in some way. Perhaps that's something that artists can actually present in science.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's where things like the John Deere thing at the end, you can really sort of very directly show someone why, very immediately sometimes show why something was relevant to them, why something, why it should be important for them. But then you still have these potential problems that if it doesn't quite work, you've missed your opportunity and no one really understands it anyway. Are you always going to go and read a little white plaque? I certainly don't always go and read it, unless it's good enough to treat me. Sorry, I don't know.
No, I was just going to say also earlier point about scientists perhaps not meeting in everyday practice, not meeting to understand philosophical science. Isn't that also connected to that? Is that we're looking at different theories and trying to decide what is preferable? then that's also what theories actually mean.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make those judgments, it's, is it an aesthetic judgment that you're making? Is it utilitarian?
Yeah.
It's not just producing theories. You have to first of all know what constitutes a good theory, a good explanation.
Well, definitely it'd be nice if there was more. If there was a broader canon of philosophy taught in art schools, because they do seem to tend, yeah, to have like a canon of texts that they really sort of prefer, as it were, sort of thing. I think one of the things that potentially can go the other way to go from science towards art and to learn, and sort of I think a lot of contemporary artists pick up on this, is not starting from theory, not theorising, like generally art practices. A lot of artists hate theory. And a lot of what they do is sort of scientific in a way, it has a subjective judgment, and it's just the artist's personal judgment of what's right and wrong, or their audience's judgment of what's right and wrong, as opposed to some objective assessment done by the community, which is science. So there's, I think, ideas from science and like how you experiment with things and how you test things, and the real world is important to a lot of artists.
See, I actually always had an interest in both art and science,
yeah.
And actually ended up studying architecture, which is kind of sandwiched between
them. Yeah.
But for me, I was filled with architecture, which I thought would be one of the best school worlds. And in a sense, it was actually worse than
most of those.
Because there were theories there, it's just that they weren't explicit,
yeah.
Which is that's the worst situation. And I think that's also true in the practice of art and study of art, which I did before.
I almost made reference to a talk I went to recently by an architectural theorist talking about critical spatial theory. Yeah, quite far from what a lot of people would necessarily think architecture deals with, but it was very much towards the art.
Thanks for joining me in thanking Joey for a wonderful talk and a fantastic discussion, and obviously science and art are important to all of us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a wonderful sidebar. I'm here with Dr. Joey O'Gorman, who just gave us a wonderful talk on creativity and science. One of the things that I was wondering about is, do you think there's an issue with how we define creativity? So, for example, a scientist may define creativity as thinking up a new idea or a new hypothesis, but you're still constrained within a certain boundary, whereas an artist, say, wouldn't have the same boundaries.
Yeah, potentially, but I'd say there's only certain types. So certain types of contemporary fine art are completely unbounded. Let's say if you think of someone playing an instrument, say a saxophone or something, they're limited by the instrument, and maybe someone who plays music's quite a good example, because you might play within a certain style, and so within those constraints you can still be very creative and you can do things. So for me there's a sort of similar thing, depending on your area of research in science, you have these constraints. And yes, ultimately there's this constraint of having to come up with something which is objectively assessed, and but yeah, I think there's I think it's still a valid term to call it creative. Yeah.
You talked a bit about how science and scientists are perceived, and do you think also there's a problem in terms of people being able to see it as being creative, in the sense that people expect science to be infallible and very defining? If scientists were able to say, well, we're not exactly sure, we don't quite know, but society and maybe the media demands that of us, and is that holding people back from understanding how creative science can be?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it's quite hard to see it as anything other than a very concrete thing. For me, one of the main reasons is this difference between pedagogic or taught science as opposed to research science. So a lot of people, their only experience of science is at school, and that's where they're taught this is concrete fact, and that can also be the source as well of some antipathy as well, because if they find it boring, or if they're not very able at doing that certain type of thing, then it can be quite an oppressive thing, and then if they stop, they might stop being interested in science from that day and never look back, apart from in anger, as it were. But yeah, so apart from the sort of difference between taught science and research science, what people were thinking about this what people expect from science and how you have to communicate science. It's also quite a problematic thing as well, because you have this, scientists aren't able to, it's not necessarily scientists not able to, but people who communicate science quite often have to say things in such simplified concrete terms that they lose all the nuance of things like risk. But especially when it comes to things like climate change, you have these problems of people not being able to talk about probabilities. They're just like sort of saying very concrete statements get put out in the press, which I don't think necessarily that's not the fault of the scientist, but that's the problem of science communication in governments and policy, which makes it very easy for other people who have different agendas to attack the science. And it's every other week where you hear something that, oh, there's a new cure for cancer, and it's never qualified by what type of cancer, how far down research is this, is this in clinical trials, or is this just one tiny observation? And then by the time it gets to media science. So yeah, I think there's a problem with media science, definitely. And the way that you can combat that is just growing more sophisticated awareness and trying to engage people more broadly.
And do you think, in terms of science education and about the creativity aspect, is it maybe we should be teaching a bit more about what we don't know rather than what we know?
Potentially. There's an interesting guy called Hasok Chang who teaches history and philosophy of science. He's just moved to Cambridge. And he says quite a lot about the benefits of having plurality and sort of trying to get away from just one conception of what science is or just one conception of what truth is. There are some benefits to having multiple different sort of visions of what something could be and multiple different interpretations, even if it's just hedging your bets to say if one thing fails, you've got something else to fall back on. So yeah, I think there could be some room for manoeuvre in science being taught a bit more nuanced way, especially at the undergraduate level. I think once you start looking at the early undergraduate and school level, you have these problems of one of the main things that taught science is doing is it's used as a basis of evaluating a student's ability to look at and manipulate scientific data. And introducing nuance into that probably makes things a little bit too complicated. So yeah, it's a really hard question. But you could potentially have maybe things introduced into other non-science courses in explaining a bit more about the history and philosophy of science, even though people sometimes worry that teaches people certain types and notions of what science are that aren't particularly representative. So yeah, it's a very complicated question.
And you talked about having to choose when you were 15 or 16 about going into art or science. And would you still make the same decision if we transported you back to that 15 or 16
year old
today?
Yeah. Yeah, at that age I had no idea what I was doing. So if I went back, I probably would do the same thing. I still have a deep affection for science. It's a really nice, worthwhile thing to do. And I think there are, especially as what art can be nowadays, I think you can come at it through different things. And I feel quite privileged in a way to have avoided some sort of art education where I've had people sort of telling me what's right and wrong. Not that all art tutors are telling people what right and wrong, but yeah, I think if I went back, I'd probably stick with the science.
Obviously, as a scientist, you've been able to make a transition into the art world and combine the two things. But if you were an artist that in later stages in your career decided that you really wished you could have gone into sciences, it's a lot more difficult. So do you think that's fair in that sense?
It might not be fair, but I think there's potential for... I think there could be far shorter training periods of doing some sort of conversion within a year or so to be able to take someone to the level of being, say, doing something technical within a lab. And then once someone's doing a job within a lab, if they're good enough, there are opportunities for them to learn part-time maybe. So while they're doing a job, they could progress and then go on towards doing a PhD. So I think there's structural problems with that, what have you, and I don't know if the funding bodies would have enough incentive to do it, but it would be really nice if that could happen. Like, it happened with medicine a few years ago with having fast track and accepting people from humanities and arts backgrounds to potentially go on and just do it relatively quickly. But yeah, the other way around is really hard.
Well, thank you very much. It was really wonderful.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found at our website, www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @OxfordSidebar and on Facebook, British Science Association, Oxfordshire Branch.